Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another Zodiac Sessions podcast. I'm your host, Blake Howard. For all of our patrons, thank you so much. Just really to everyone for your incredible support. I thought I would dip back into the well. I do have a lot more extended Zodiac Sessions chats from the show to release to you guys. But as the tagline on the poster says, there are more ways to lose your life to to a serial killer. I have lived and breathed that with this film. I've lived and breathed that with this show. So I've been kind of like, I needed to have a break from Zodiac for a time after that final episode aired. It was such an incredible experience. And I think maybe it's the best technical thing we've ever achieved here. So I'm pretty proud of it. But one of... a new friend, if you like, that I've been making along the way, sort of stumbled into the life of the Zodiac Chronicle podcast when I stumbled into his life. I stumbled into obsessing over his absolutely terrific podcast, which he's a filmmaker himself as well, but he's got a terrific podcast, which right now is in its light the fuselage stage. But really, he and Drew Taylor have created Light the Fuse, which is the ultimate Mission Impossible podcast. And when he doesn't obsess over everything Tom Cruise, including his haircuts, his stunts, whether or not there is or isn't a submarine in his upcoming films, he is maybe one of the peak Zodiac obsessives that I've met along the Zodiac Chronicle journey. So I thought it would be kind of remiss of me because we didn't get a chance. Excuse me, my voice is like turning like Kathleen Turner in the middle of this goddamn intro. I don't know what the hell's going on, but we didn't get a chance to talk on the show. He will be a part of our next Podcaster and Commander series as I start to build and create and shape that. But I thought it would be great to get Mr. Charles Hood on a Zodiac session to talk all things Zodiac. Charles, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I'm, absolutely obsessed with this movie, like you said. So I was listening to every minute, pouring over your podcast that you did, the miniseries you did on Zodiac, and I loved every minute of it. It was such an amazing breakdown of the whole movie, and it made me, I've seen the movie, I've kept a log of the last 11 years now of all the movies that I've watched. A few friends and I have like a Google Doc where we share all the movies that we watch, and I've like done a count, and that's by far the movie I've watched the most in the last 11 years.
It's such a thing for fans of Zodiac to share a Google Doc to track each other's movies.
Yes, it is. They are all my friends are also obsessed with the movie as well. So yeah.
Oh God, that's so wonderful. But yeah, look, you sent me a lovely note. Actually, you were pouring through the series. I thought this might be a nice spot to start because we're talking about, you know, you wrestling with Armstrong as a character, because Toshi is, you know, Dave Toski's obsessed and Armstrong is on the outside. And we were, there had been a few times that we've been talking about throughout the series about how Mark Anthony Edwards as Armstrong was like an amazing character. And I always felt that he was in it, and like, unlike, you know, Gyllenhaal or unlike Mark Ruffalo, who, and even to a certain extent, Robert Downey Jr., how he was able to disconnect himself. And we were kind of getting into a talk about like, what's your interpretation? Like how his obsession rolls. And so I think that would be a nice spot to start, because I've always found Armstrong, and when I first preliminarily watched it, you know, I think, or at least the first 20 times, oh my God, I don't even know how many times I've watched Zodiac these days, but, or in parts, that's the other thing. When I was doing Heat, people were like, how many times have you watched the movie? I said, look, probably conservatively 200. I said, but I couldn't count all the times that I just watched 20 minutes of it. And you don't log 20 minutes on Letterboxd or in your shared Google Doc like a psycho. Yeah. Like, hey guys, I watched 20 minutes of Zodiac this afternoon. Like, your friends would literally go, Charles, you need help. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. But yeah, I watched so many times segments of this movie for the show. And I kept thinking about Armstrong, and I was just like, there's a point, I don't know, like, whether you're doing an art project, whether you're making a film, whether you've done a job, whether you do something, that there's a point where you're like, I don't know what else I've got. Like, I don't know what else I've got to give to this that's going to make this better. And so when I've always now come back to it and I've watched him and I've watched him to that point, I come to this realization that I'm like, I feel a great deal of empathy for him instead of the preliminary betrayal that I must have felt, you know, feeling more aligned to Ruffalo and Toski, because I'm like, no, he realized that to give any more of himself was to take away from his life, to take away from being a dad, to take away even more so being a husband, being a dad, having a family. And I think that that's a kind of brave thing at the end to be like, I can't do a brave awareness. I can't do anything else. If I give anything more of myself, I'm done. I can't do it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that was something that listening to your show, it made me think about that I hadn't really dug into as much before, but the Armstrong-Toski relationship. And I think you actually responded to my email, and I think you might have disagreed with me a little bit, and that's totally fine. It's just, I think that's the great thing about this movie, is that there's so much to dig into, and that's why it totally justifies the whole dedication you've given to the show, I mean, to the movie. And it was just like, there was a conversation somewhere in the middle of your miniseries about Toski and Armstrong's relationship. And it made me start to think about how, like, you start to realize, like, Toski he's so obsessed in that first section of his first section of the movie in the second act. And he is he calls Armstrong and wakes him up in the middle of the night to tell it, because he's got the idea about there aren't a lot of basements in California. And Armstrong's like, you can tell he woke up Armstrong to call him and tell him this. And Armstrong is like, you know, poor guy, just trying to get some sleep. Like, he can't check with the city planners in the middle of the night. He's like, yeah, I'll check with the city planners in the morning. And then he's like, he even tells Toski, like, get some sleep, I think is what he says to him. It's like, he's trying so hard to keep the boundaries up of making this just like a normal case. And Toski, like, refuses to let that be the case. He wants it to be everything because he's so obsessed with it. And it's like, in that, I think after, you know, after Armstrong leaves and Toski kind of slows down a little bit, then, you know, then it's like the obsession gets taken on by Graysmith more than anyone. And then Graysmith's the one who's bothering Toski. But in that first section where it's Toski and Armstrong, it's like the first time we meet Toski, he's dead asleep in bed. And that's like the only time we see him actually like trying to live his life. From that point on, he's just obsessed. Yeah. And he's like trying to get Armstrong to be that same level of obsession. Like, when Armstrong's just enjoying his lunch, you know, he's like sitting there eating his lunch at the counter. And then
he pushes him away from his own lunch. It's the most, it's such a fun detail of like, I don't know if I've got a dear friend, one of my, I would consider him like a brother. And every time we go to, in my local area, we just pop down to a cafe and a few of my friends live around there. And so we don't really tell each other we're all going there. It's just kind of an agreement that we're going to be there and the kids are going to be there and like come in and we'll just grab an extra chair for the table. And he is literally my, you're going to eat that? Like that's, he's my, you're going to eat that. So if I'm halfway through like a delicious like bacon and egg roll or something and there's another half of the plate, he's kind of like, you're going to eat that? And I'm like, I just push it over to him. I'm just like, yeah, take the sandwich. And I just love, that's a, such a beautiful personal, like, you have to be a certain level of closeness and intimacy as friends that your friend can literally like bully you out of your sandwich and you just walk over and start making the calls on their behalf. You know, that's
yeah,
a special thing. I love that scene.
It's such a great, I mean, it's such a subtle, I mean, that movie, you know, Fincher before that was always like putting his style out there. So at the forefront, and then you see something like Zodiac, that scene's a oneer and I don't think the camera moves. It's just holding there right there for that kind of like medium wide two shot of just the two of them at that diner and they just have their interaction. That's the whole scene. And it's just so simple and so perfect. And you just let those two actors play off each other and they're just so great with each other. But yeah, so Armstrong, he's just trying to take a lunch break, poor guy. And then Toski comes in and is like, hey, I got more work for you to do. And Armstrong's like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll go check. You know, and it's just like, you just feel bad for the guy. And then like, you know, they're back on Washington and Cherry on Armstrong's birthday, like parked there at the corner, you know, watching that spot. It was just like, I mean, you don't know how that got to be, but like, you know, Toski was the one who was like, let's go back to that corner and sit there on your birthday, Armstrong. Armstrong's like, yeah, yeah, okay, all right, let's go back and sit there on the fucking corner.
Happy,
sure.
Happy birthday. He doesn't even know it's his birthday. Some other hump in the force is like, happy birthday. Happy
he
birthday.
Doesn't even know it's his own partner's birthday the first time they, yeah, their first scene together. It's like, Toski, That relationship is just so fascinating to me. And that scene, I mean, the scene where Armstrong says goodbye and we say goodbye to him, it's such a perfect ending for his character. And like you feel a little bit of a betrayal, but Ruffalo's performance is so pitch perfect in that scene where he's like, you can tell he feels a little bit betrayed and he's upset, but then he puts on a brave face to like make Armstrong feel better. And he's like, no, it's fine. Like, you get to try the Japanese food, you know, like he's like trying his best to like give Armstrong peace, to be like, you're being able to walk away right now. I can't do that, but like, I respect you for it and goodbye and like no hard feelings. And then you see Armstrong walk off and, you know, it's like a little bit hokey that his wife is waiting for him there, but it's so perfect because he's just like, that's Armstrong's ending. He walks off, gets to be with his family, and he's saying goodbye to this. And it's just so great.
The one detail I love about that is what we know about both of these guys is how many times have they ever been on time? How many times have they ever gotten back when they said they were going to get back? Like for anyone who's got a job, it's just a great relatable detail. Right. There have been so many times for these podcasts, for every podcast I've ever done, where I tell my wife, bless her heart, that I'm going to be done at X time. I'm sure I'll be done at X time.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, 50 minutes later than I said, I emerged from this office and she's like, you're 50 minutes late, you know? And I just kind of like, I'm sorry. Like it was good. You know, it was happening. And so I love that time that she's down there, he's on time. He's arriving home when he's said.
Yeah.
And it's probably the only time that he could. Let's go back as well. We're going at this thing sideways, and this is what I like about the sessions. I can be a little bit free-flowing when we talked about it. One thing we haven't talked about yet together was when you saw Zodiac originally. I know that you're a Fincher fan, obviously, like up-and-coming filmmaker. He's one of our guys. We're of the same generation. So you kind of like, you're buying a ticket no matter what he's doing. But when you went to see that, I went and saw it on like a Saturday night with friends. We went out to dinner afterwards. I was a rare person in that group of friends. Everyone was like, oh my God, that was so like bleak and disturbing. And I didn't like it. And I was like, this is the best movie I've ever seen. Like I was just like, I was all in right from there. And they're like, are you serious? I'm like, yeah, like it's life. I kind of was right on there from that first thing. And then as time grew and obviously, you know, we're talking all the way back in like 2007. There's not really streaming. There's like DVDs and Blu-rays and that's what's ubiquitous. And so you're just dying to get your hands on the DVD or eventually the Blu-ray. And that's the time that you can then sort of pore over it and revisit it. But I wondered, what was your experience when you first saw the film, and was it that immediate for you to have that love for it? Because I know how much you love it now.
Yeah, I tend to, like, when I, my favorite movies of the year, I end up usually going to see in the theater at least three times. I just, like, become obsessed. And this was one of those movies. I remember a big group of my friends, we all got tickets for, like, opening day, and all went to go see it together. And I'm pretty sure we all loved it immediately. We were all just fascinated by the whole thing. And I had a couple of friends who, and my editor, who's one of my best friends, who's my roommate in college, he also became obsessed, and we ended up going, actually, while it was at the tail end of its theatrical run, I think we went to a screening with it was a Q&A with the editor Angus Wall that I got through a friend of mine. I was able to go to that screening. My good buddy Grant, he's an editor, he came and we ended up talking to Angus Wall for like a half hour after the screening on the sidewalk afterwards. We were just totally obsessed. And because the movie, it just leaves you wanting, there's a reason why you keep coming back to it. There's a reason why I keep coming back to it. And some people keep coming back to it, I think, is there's so many questions that are left with you, especially after that first time I saw it. I was just like, wait, what? Like the way that it ended, and the way I was just like, I cannot believe that, like, how could it not be Arthur Lee Allen for sure? And like, what was the whole deal with Bob Vaughn and that whole like thing? I was just like, what? Like I like just became so obsessed. I went out and got both of the books that Robert Graysmith wrote. It was like, I think Zodiac and Zodiac Unmasked, I think they're both called. And immediately read those, and like underlined passages, and like took notes, and like, you know, in the first book he wrote, he's using code names, he didn't use the actual names of people. And so I, like, you know, found out what the actual names of the people, and like had a little key for myself so I would know who he's talking about when he's talking about them. And I like just became obsessed, like fucking Graysmith. I mean, it's just like my wife, who actually, like, we were high school sweethearts, we broke up in college. We actually got back together Valentine's Day of 2007, but we were long distance at the time. And I remember telling her to go see it, and she went to go see it with a friend, and she was terrified of it. But she also was, even though she was terrified after seeing the movie, she was so taken in by it as well that I think she might be the only person who's watched the movie that I know more than me. Oh. She's so obsessed with it and watches it all the time. And that's how I'll catch like 20 minutes of here or there. Like if she's got it on, I'll come in and watch little pieces of it. Anyway, I'm kind of all over the place, but she and I watch it every July 4th. We watch it other than that as well. And we've gone and visited all of the
Zodiac sites. July 4th. That's a good one. That's a good one for those listening. Every July 4th, throw it on.
Oh yeah. July 4th, we put it on.
That's a great one.
And I became so totally obsessed with it and read up all that stuff about it and read the Graysmith books. And so it was an immediate obsession for me, and it has not slowed down at all. And it took us probably until, I think, 2018 was when we finally finished seeing. It was kind of like, I was directing a show up in Portland, and so that gave us the opportunity. When we were driving back from Portland, we stopped in the Bay Area and visited a couple of the Zodiac sites. And then there was another time where we were like vacationing in like Morongo Valley or something like that. And so then we were like, oh, let's stop by Riverside on the way home and let's check out the library. And so we went there, and, you know, so we've gone to all the different Zodiac sites. My wife and I have done it together. So and you know, it's an obsession, to say the least.
I would really like to take I really need to get over to LA. I feel like the Zodiac would be like the second part of the trip, the Zodiac sites, that I'd probably do by myself because it would freak my wife out. But I would absolutely make my wife come on a heat pilgrimage and take her to every site that was in heat. I'd be like, babe, you can see there's the airport. You can see that. There's the diner. That's where Breeden parked his car. Here's where.
There's a couple of sites here in LA too. There's like it's closed now, sadly, but there was a diner that my friends and I used to go to. It was Callahan's Diner. And that's where that scene we were talking about earlier between Armstrong and Toski. And then later Toski goes there with Graysmith a couple of times. But I think what's interesting, that's what's so fascinating, like, it's not the same diner. I think two of the scenes were shot in the actual Callahan's Diner, but the final scene where it's the climax of the movie, that's the greatest thing about this movie too. The climax of the movie is two guys sitting in a diner talking. and it's unbelievably compelling and it's so great. But that one is a set. It's not the actual Callahan Center. Anyway, this is just random tidbits about locations.
This is tidbits. That's what my friends tease me about. They're like, "Oh, is it another movie with two guys talking in a diner? I guess you're going to do a whole podcast about it." And I can't argue. I just have to laugh and go, "Yep, yeah, that's the kind of thing that I like. Two guys sitting in a diner talking about their dreams, figuring shit out." Oh, no, that's good. Like, I'm really, it's heartening to hear, and it's also, you know. I remember when I was doing film studies at university, and I had this teacher who was doing this course on violence in film. And we were talking about, like, I think what Zodiac did for me around this time, because he always talked about, like, you know, action and then violence and movie violence. You know, some people are like, "Oh, it desensitizes you. It's this, it's that." But I've never been more disturbed about the reality of violence depicted on film than in that at the Lake Berryessa scene in this movie. Like, the violence, the violence that happens in the film to you, and thankfully Fincher knows how powerful it is because he cuts away after just about 8 or 9 seconds of it. He knows that level of undiluted violence coming through the screen at you with the oral and the visuals and the music and the heightened performances and the big faces who are experiencing it. For this movie, ever since then, like, a lot of movie violence or a lot of stuff that happens in movies, like action stuff, is not disturbing anymore. It's just like watching, a Warner Brothers cartoon, you know? Like, it's just, like, when Rambo rips a guy's throat out in Rambo 4, I'm like, "Huh, that's fun." And it's just not, it doesn't disturb me because it's not, it actually doesn't, it, there's no, like, real physics to people. There's no real fears. But in this movie, that I remember is that, and then what's even stranger about that is that this movie's process, you know, whether you call it process porn or termite art, it makes it rewatchable. This is the trap I've fallen into with some of the shows that I've done, is that in the middle of the project that I'm doing, I start watching something else as a relief, as a getaway from the key focus of what I'm working on, and then that catches me. And Zodiac had been a film that I'd been watching countless times. I'd put it on, and probably a little bit less since I've had kids, because it's really disturbing. and I don't want to freak them out. You know, slightly different from All the President's Men, where you can just have, you know, guys smoking in offices, and that's fine.
Right.
You know, I'm quite lucky with that, but Zodiac's pretty disturbing. But they just catch you. There is, despite the fact that it's so impactful, it also has this deep comfort that what I really tried to explore on the show is, like, that inexplicable comfort that we all get from watching this thing happen, and watching this series of terrible events depicted, why it's so, I don't know, relatable.
Yeah, I think... It's something just so mesmerizing about this movie that, I mean, I think it's just not your, I mean, I think you talked about this before in your show, I'm sure, plenty of times, but, you know, it's like all the murders happen in the first 25 minutes.
Yes.
And then it's like 2 hours and 20 minutes of, you know, just, like, I think what Fincher described it as is, it's like a being locked inside a filing cabinet.
Yes.
It's what the movie feels like. And you're just sort of going through all this information. It's something that I think he's done so well. I think from Zodiac on, not that I love all of his movies, even going back to Alien 3, I know people shit on that movie, and I think it's actually really great. I love that one.
My great friend Walter Chaw, who's one of the world's best film critics, worked with Fincher very briefly on The Chauvoir, he did for Netflix with those sort of like cinephile documentary style things. And Walter... spoke about Walter Hill's 48 Hours, which is one of his favorite films. And when he was doing that, he said, he told Fincher, he goes, "I love Alien 3. And Fincher goes, "Oh, Walter, shut up," or something like that. No. And Walter's just like laughed. He's like, "No, I really like it. I think it's great." And
yeah, Fincher has definitely disowned that one. They were doing like a career retrospective edit of like all of his footage. I think for the DGA or something, when Mank came out, and there was footage of Alien 3 included in the montage, and Fincher was like, "Actually, can you cut that out?" So he just doesn't even count it as a movie.
Excise that, if you please.
But just from the opening studio, the logo with the Elliot Goldenthal, like the way he alters the music in the Fox fanfare, it's just like, oh my God, I'm in. I'm so in this movie. I like both cuts, the whatever. Anyway, whatever. That's a digression. What was I talking about? So yeah, like the way that he can, I think from Zodiac on, has like, it's in Social Network, it's in Gone Girl, it's in Dragon Tattoo, the way that he can like throw unbelievable amounts of information at you, and he does not hold your hand, he's not waiting for you to catch up. He's just like, this is it, this is what's happening, and if you can't keep up, he understands like that the first time you see the movie, if you don't catch all that information, it's actually okay, and it actually makes you want to come back and dig into all those little things, you know, the every little tiny detail that comes in, and everything comes through. It's just done with such care. And it keeps you coming back. I think that's part of it. But it obviously doesn't encompass all of the obsession of wanting to come back and see these characters. And it's so hard to depict obsession in a movie and make it, you know, compelling. You know, I don't think a lot of people are able to do that well. I think obviously like Hitchcock and Vertigo and, you know, De Palma's done it plenty of times, and but it's hard to do that, and it's hard to do it. Those obsessions in Hitchcock and De Palma are more like maybe sexually or romantically based. This is like information based obsession, and to keep that exciting for an audience is just unheard of. How do you do that? It's amazing. And
I think you nailed something there, which is even in scenes that are so fleeting in his films, especially in this latter period since Zodiac, and always really in his films, he's so dedicated to everything that they're creating, you know, the specificity of all of the different locations and all these things, and making sure that every detail of every location is perfect and precise, that if you are even minutely aware of what it takes to have a set or a house or a whatever police station look boundless, filled with people moving around, one person smoking over here, one person's grabbing a coffee, another person, three people having a conversation, all these things happening, and how quickly he'll move past it. I think there's something in like real cinephiles' heads that goes, wait, like he literally, they vacated a floor of a building here, and every desk and every drawer has something in it. You know, it's just, there's something about like creating these amazing and immaculate and perfect things, and then watching filmmakers navigating through them quickly. And I think that's the older President's Men of it all for me, is like they had the trash from the Washington Post in the bins in the set of All the President's Men, because they had it shipped in because they just wanted the office to feel completely lived in. And it does. And there's stuff that's not happening in the immediate foreground. There's stuff in the deep, 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 deep background of like three people talking in an office to each other all the time. Sometimes with the actual lead actors portraying their characters, but we just don't hear what they're saying. They're having a separate conversation, what you're hearing. And I think that that's the reward. I think there's just something about in Fincher's work recently, and maybe it's all of his work, it's just like he's got an audience that seems pretty tuned into like what he's trying to do. And so when we see all these details, you're just like, oh my God. And even up to Mank, which, you know, some people loved, and it had a little bit of a mixed reception, also probably because it went, you know, didn't get much of a theatrical run, I think is part of it. But like they retweaked the whole sound for the movie, like they mixed the whole movie and then they remixed it to sound like a movie from the 1930s. You know, the sound is weird. Like I saw it in a theater, so I was blessed to have like a proper sound system, and you can just hear this like slight tinge, slight crackle, slight weird echo that they've just like, we're gonna take it back through mono, right? We're gonna digitally mix this huge movie, and we're gonna just squeeze it back through mono. It's gonna have these weird crackles and out of the register, and yeah. So I think that that's one of the things that's like kind of amazing about it.
Yeah, I mean it's the amount of care that's put into every aspect of the filmmaking.
Yes,
and you know, you hear the, like I've heard that. I don't remember who said it, but so someone was saying like Fincher can do pretty much every job on set just as good or better than anybody who's doing that job. And so he's like so demanding of everybody to make sure that they are doing that as great as it deserves, the attention that it deserves. Yeah, I mean, it makes me, yeah, I revisit all of the movies. I mean, I think it's not just Zodiac as the obsession, because it's all like also like, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Dragon Tattoo, and I watch that one a lot.
Me too.
And I think that, you know, for someone who never gets any credit for, or people say that he can't show, like he'd show emotions or anything like that in his movies, like his movies are cold or whatever. Like that movie has so much emotion to me that gets me every time I watch it. Yes. from both the Christopher Plummer story when he gets reunited at the end, and I don't want to say, I guess if people haven't seen it, I don't know if it's spoilers or whatever, but whatever. There's that reunion at the end that gets me emotional every time. And then there's the very end of the movie, which just breaks my fucking heart every time I watch it. And
leather jacket in the trash. It's awful.
Yeah. Oh my God. And that piece of music too, from Reznor and Ross, it's just like, oh my God, just kills me every time. It's so good. Their relationship, Daniel Craig and Rooney Mara, like their characters, is just so good.
Yeah. And I want to recommend to anyone, if you can get your hands on the Dragon Tattoo disc that has the commentary, it's so nice because Daniel Craig is a phenomenal actor, and like, obviously he's James Bond. So once you have a role like James Bond, you become larger than life. But Fincher just praised everything he did. He's like, he's just amazing. He can just turn up and give you everything he's got 20 different ways. He's a proper, like, I feel like it's like with a legend like Fincher who just like gushes about you as an actor, like, and you know, it's rare to hear him like properly gush about an actor. Like he gushes about Kate Blanchett and he gushes about Daniel Craig and he gushes about Mark Ruffalo oh my God, I'm trying to think of who else in the other commentary tracks, but that particular one shocked me because, oh, and obviously Rooney, right? Like he's just like, she's amazing. But the Daniel Craig of it all, I love in that movie because I think he's such an underrated performance. I just love even the way he hangs his glasses off of his ear. I'm like,
oh yeah, yeah.
He does that. He does
that. Well, I think that's something that started also with Zodiac, is like, there's a certain Fincher character that I feel like happens in a lot of these movies where like that just, and this is me, I don't know, maybe going out too much of a limb, but I feel like he has this sort of metrosexual.
Wait. You think that you, after I've done that, you're going I just want to tell all future guests and listeners, no one can go far enough out on a limb on any show except these. Please.
I like, there's the way when you hear Fincher talk, the way he speaks, the way he acts in his interviews, and you know, I've listened to all those commentaries, are so great. That Dragon Tattoo commentary, like you said, is so great. I love the moment when Daniel Craig like knocks a water bottle off the fridge, and the way Fincher describes it, he's like, yeah, sometimes if he says like 40 takes or whatever, then you luck into Daniel Craig doing a Fred Astaire move to go over and catch this water bottle before it hits the ground or whatever. Anyway, so that commentary is so great. But Fincher, he has this kind of like just way of speaking, this sort of like metrosexual presentation, the way he dresses and all this stuff. And I feel like it bleeds into, I think it's like it's Robert Downey Jr. in Zodiac. It's Daniel Craig in Dragon Tattoo. It's a little bit of Justin Timberlake in Social Network. It's a little bit of Neil Patrick Harris in Gone Girl. Like to me, these are all, it's actually a little bit also, there's so many lines that when they do the big reveal of Stellan Skarsgård and Dragon Tattoo, that scene in the basement, the way that he speaks in that scene to me, I'm like, Skarsgård is just doing a Fincher impersonation. he's like, you and I aren't that different. You and I, what does he say? Like, we're not that different. You and I, we both have obsessions. Mine just require more towels or whatever. The way he says it in this specific cadence, it just feels so Fincher.
Can I get some internet boffins? Maybe it's your boy who's an editor. We need to cut. Daniel Craig has two of the best psychosexually loaded scenes in cinema, like almost in a few years back to back. He has that one at the end of Dragon Tattoo where he's like, oh, I've never had a man in here, and all of that. And then he has that brilliant one with with Javier Bardem in Skyfall, where he's like, "You think it's right. my first time?"
Oh my god,
someone
I love that
needs
line.
To clip them together so we could just watch those scenes, just those those scenes over and again, because they're just so goddamn wonderful. They're just amazing.
Yeah,
but that Stellan Skarsgård scene is just, he's out of this world. He's just,
yeah,
he's so good.
But there's something about those male characters, the ones that I listed, I think that are all kind of similar. They're not like super masculine. They're kind of, they, you know, they have, I don't know, just, I can't quite put my finger on exactly what I'm trying to say, but you know what I mean? Like they all kind of have a similar quality that feels kind of Fincher-esque, where they're like very intellectual and not like super athletic guys or anything like that. They're just like these kind of, I don't know, metrosexual characters, if that makes any sense.
It's so funny to be like, what's the director's avatar in this movie? Because everyone like harps on the Chris Nolan of it all. It's like, oh yeah, you know, Robert Pattinson's just playing Chris Nolan in Tenet, and Chris Nolan is just like wishing he was Leonardo DiCaprio in Inception and those sorts of things. And so it's like, that's funny to be like, where is the guy? Where is the guy? Where is he?
There's also, of course, like there's the aspect of like the, because there's Rooney Mara in Dragon Tattoo, and there's, you know, there's Jesse Eisenberg in Social Network. But it's like the aspect of like the young, brash, smartest person in the room. And that's totally a different side of Fincher, I think, that yes. shows up in these movies as well. But yeah, I'm just always thinking about, I don't know, that side of Fincher too, that I think that that way of speaking and everything that he does, I feel is like, it springs up in those other side characters that show up in these movies, I feel like.
That's a reading that's so nice. That's I like that. It's something we didn't explore. Where is Fincher in this movie? And I feel like, yeah, there he is. He's right there. And you know where Fincher is in Zodiac? He's Bob Vaughn.
You think so?
Because in that moment, Charles Fleischer. So when I was speaking to Robert Graysmith, which was insane, by the way, and I still
I know I'm like I was just on pins and needles listening to all those episodes, hearing him talk about all that stuff.
I can't believe it. Anyway, so I'm still a bit. I still forget. Like, it's almost like your brain. You have to keep cognitive distance of like when I spoke to X person. You're like, oh my god, that's just that couldn't have been real. It was too awesome. But when I spoke to him, he just said that he. And he validated it. It was actually a conversation with James Vanderbilt, where it was Jamie Vanderbilt, Fincher, Brad Fisher, Graysmith. They're all talking. And in one of their conversations, they get to the basement. And
I loved this part. Yeah.
And Jamie Vanderbilt was just like, Fincher goes, Robert, why the hell did you go down in the basement?
I love that.
And that was like last. And he's like, yeah, Fincher's like, why'd you go in the basement? He goes, I don't know. Like, and I think that when you then get to that scene, you got Charles Fleischer, because it's like, oh, the guy who did Roger Rabbit. And there's like this perverse play that Vanderbilt and Fisher and Fincher are doing. Oh, we're going to cast Charles Fleischer. That's hilarious. And then Fleischer coming into the movie and just like literally being this massive, you know, embodiment of a red herring, just to be there to like poke you. And then how much fun he has. I'm like, that's Fincher. He's having much fun poking and prodding and scaring the living daylights out of us. And like the reality of the situation is he did really go down into that basement, which is insane. And it's like a paragraph in both of the books. And you're like, why would you do that? I think it's,
You connected it, didn't you, in your show, you connected it to the Dragon Tattoo.
Yes.
Moment when he's like, you know, that great line Stellan Skarsgård has, where he's like, it's hard to believe people are, you know, afraid to offend someone.
More afraid to be rude.
Yeah.
More afraid to be rude than to die.
Than their own personal safety. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. God, I love that movie.
Oh, man. Well, look, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I'm sure we could probably go on for many hours, but I just want to say thank you so much for saying such lovely things about the show, and thank you so much for getting in touch. I've been wanting this to happen for a long time, and I love, I'm not going to share them all. I may share one photo of Charles doing his best Mark Ruffalo impression, which he sent me, which I love. which I absolutely love.
Which one? I did one in Callahan's Diner, and I did another one on the street at Washington and Cherry.
Either one of those.
You
one
can do both of those.
One where you're stuffing your face with a burger, one where you're standing in Washington and Cherry. I love that. They're both.
I was actually there having breakfast, so it was two pancakes that I put together to make it look like a burger. But yes.
I didn't notice that. The commitment to the bit, ladies and gentlemen, it's just fantastic. Look, but Charles, thank you, man, so much. It's been so great staying in touch for the series, and I thought I would finally poke my head up for air now to get this out. And I will probably put a few longer episodes just on our Patreon if people are keen and you're listening. This one will probably go up on our Patreon and actually go into our main feed as a little bonus episode of a Zodiac session for you guys listening. And one last thing I want to tell you as well, because these episodes will only go to our Patreon. So Donal Logue, who's one of the stars of Zodiac, came on the show, and we recorded an episode of podcast that went for something like 2.5 hours. And there were stories about making the Thin Red Line. There were stories about everything. Like, just this amazing stuff that has just never been released yet. And I've just been waiting because I'm like, I'm going to just start putting those out on our Patreon. So if you want to hear some great, fantastic movie stories from the great Donal Logue, you're going to have to get onto our Patreon for that. But one of the things he said was hilarious. The great Angus Wall, who you said you were chatting to on the side of the street, right, who edited Zodiac, he said one time he was in New York City and he was walking around and Angus was in a park, like sitting down. He said, hey, Angus, how you doing? And Angus was sitting on his laptop editing Zodiac. He's like, hey man, I'm just editing. Like, he was just like taking a break, getting outside, took it out on his laptop. I'm like, oh my god, that is the coolest thing ever. Like, you're in a nice sunshiny day in New York City in the park, and there's Angus Wall, like, you know, typing something on his laptop. Amazing. But man, thank you so much for this. Please shout out, I know that most people, and it'll all be linked in the show notes and things like that, but please shout out the great Light the Fuse and Light the Fuselage podcast and give a little shout out. Come on. And any other little shorts or films or anything like that that's coming out that people need to check out?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So Light the Fuse is for all things Mission Impossible. I think it's like a great show that's about filmmaking, but it's through the lens of Mission Impossible. So even if you just have a slight interest in Mission Impossible, but you like, you know, you want to hear about great filmmaking, we get all these amazing people who worked on the movies. We get, you know, I think people who are unsung heroes in the business, like cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, you know, composers, everybody who worked on these movies, who are all amazing at what they do. And they're given so much creative freedom to do what they, to make these, those movies as great as they are. So yeah, that's Light the Fuse, which is anywhere you listen to podcasts, but go to our website, lightthefusepodcast.com, and you'll see, you know, where to get to there. And there's an episode guide with a whole bunch of show notes for all of our episodes. We've had almost 200 episodes now.
Wow.
Which is crazy. And just now it's on the same spot, but Light the Fuselage, we're just doing this. It's just a stupid pun title for Top Gun Maverick. We're just doing a little mini series about Top Gun Maverick right now. And so we've got Eddie Hamilton on, the editor, right now, which is this amazing, epic chat with him.
We also had
Kaczynski, the director. That was a great chat.
I mean, amazing with Kaczynski. But let me tell you, as a real geek who truly, Light the Fuse is a brilliant show, and just the amazing digressions you take, some of the filmmakers that come on the show who've been part of the mission. Was it cinematographer? Was it Bob Richardson that you guys had on?
Robert Elswit was the
Robert Elswit. I'm sorry,
Four and Five.
Yeah. Robert Elswit coming on was one of my favorite conversations of all time. A person who gives no fucks about anything.
That was pretty early on, and that was like one of the big things that broke through and got us a bunch of news attention, because I asked him, "Will you work with Paul Thomas Anderson again?" And he said, "Probably not." And that like got all this in. Like, that was like our first big like breakthrough. I mean, we'd had Christopher McQuarrie on before that, I think, but that was like a big deal that got a lot of news attention from because people were like heartbroken and be like, oh my god, what, why are they not gonna work together again? It was crazy.
That was crazy. One of my favorite episodes. But even in your latest episode with Eddie Hamilton, geeking out about using the exact right fonts in Top Gun Maverick's opening credits just got me right in my heart.
Too much about fonts.
No, you didn't. You talked exactly the right amount, because I even said to my friends, I'm like, you know, they're like, oh, Top Gun Maverick, good. I'm like, it's amazing. It's just incredible. One of the best cinematic experiences I can remember. And I'm like, it had me at the fonts, like the font in the opening credits.
When
the font came right, I was like, oh boy, this is so good. It's so good.
But I should also say I am a director. I have, I don't, you know, if you're in the States, I'm not sure where these things are outside of the States, but I have my movie that I directed and co-wrote is called Night Owls. It's on HBO Max currently. It's also on Canopy, I think, which is that service that you get if you have a library card for free.
We've got Canopy. We've got Canopy in Oz, so you could probably check it out on that. But with HBO Max, if for any of our Oz listeners, jump onto Foxtel or Binge, I think it's here in Australia, which is like the kind of, they have a deal with HBO Max that certain things jump over. So yeah, absolutely jump over there and check it out. Or get a VPN, guys, and sort yourself out with HBO Max. Yeah, I mean,
it's rentable. Yeah, it's rentable on Amazon and Apple and stuff like that too. And then I did a movie a couple years ago. I directed it. I did not write it. It's called A Nasty Piece of Work. It was part of this Blumhouse series of anthology movies they did called Into the Dark. And they did a movie every month. It was for a different holiday, and I got to do the Christmas movie. And it's this, you know, kind of very, very dark comedy, like an even darker version of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, somehow. And it's called A Nasty Piece of Work. That's on Hulu in the States. And I know they have Blumhouse does distribution through other avenues outside of the United States. So I'm not sure where it is. I don't think Hulu exists outside of the United States. So I'm not sure where that
would
be.
It's sort of on, we have Disney Plus Star here. So maybe it's there. I'll see if I can find it. I'll make sure I link it to the right stuff. But this has been a treat, Charles. Thank you so much for chatting.
Yeah.
We'll probably chat again, maybe back on your feed. I think I'm going to come over and visit you and Drew to talk some Top Gun Mav in more detail, hopefully. I'm looking forward to that. Look, any chance I can to gush, and any chance I get. And I was trying.
And I'm gonna crash your Master and Commander podcast. I can't wait. I love that movie so much. Even if you don't have me, I'm just gonna be listening to every single episode.
No, you're great. You're on. You're absolutely on.
I'm forcing you at gunpoint. I'm paying you right now. I just Venmo'd you to make sure that I get on the show.
I'm gonna use this episode. I'm gonna use this right now to say, Academy Award winning director Pete Ramsey, who directed Into the Spider-Verse, is a huge Peter Weir head, and he will be on the show.
Oh, amazing.
Walter Chaw, who is an incredible Peter Weir head too, is on the show really to talk about what some people may not know about Walter. He's also one of the most incredible, insightful people to talk about romantic poetry. So we start going down a deep dive on Coleridge. Andrew Colley, who co-wrote the film, has done a massive, epic chat with us about making it, about what it was like to work with Weir. Lee Zachariah, who's one of my dear friends, a great film critic and a producer here in Oz, of like lots of different news, and an author, he's on the show. Peter Weir himself is on ever so briefly, so I'm just managing everyone's expectations, but I'm just waiting because Captain Jack himself, Russell Crowe, will be on the show.
What?
It's just not recorded yet. So when that happens, when Captain Jack comes on and I get to see the lay of the land of what we have, I will then, like, what we've kind of turned this show into when we do our big series is kind of like audio documentaries. So I kind of like get my footage together, and then I have a general gist of how the show is going to work. And then we script the show and we work how the show is going to work out and how I want you guys to hear it. And so I'm now just waiting, biding my time very patiently while Mr. Russell Crowe is filming a film. And as soon as he's off that film and he has a moment of time, I'm going to get a couple of hours with Lucky Jack.
Oh my God.
And
then
we're going to launch this Podcaster and Commander podcast with a bang. But when that happens, Charles, you're going to get a bat signal almost immediately that says, you're going to get a bell, and your watch is coming up on the HMS Surprise. So it's going to be pretty exciting when that all sort of starts to go down.
I cannot wait to hear that. That's awesome.
Guys, thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you on another episode of Zodiac Sessions or anything we're doing at One Heat Minute Productions very soon. Thank you. Hi, this is Blake Howard, host and producer of One Heat Minute Productions podcast. We dive into the great and underappreciated cinematic works, often 1 minute or one scene at a time. Our crew of guests are some of the most wonderful filmmakers, writers, authors, and critics ever assembled. Our shows include One Heat Minute, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, Increment Vice, and right now, Zodiac Chronicle. Check out oneheatminute.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.